say, I think I could sing and shear a few sheep at the same time.
I could think of a few things I could do while singing, but that ain't one of them. Maybe that was the problem. Anyway, I was already missing my own band. I hadn't given up yet. I've been trying to get them to do an album for 4 years, and this detour made me more determined than ever. To tell the truth, one of the reasons I tried to do the thing with Jimmy Page was because I was feeling bereft. My mother had just died. Joe, my brother, was mad at me for working with other songwriters. I felt he was trying to get back at me by doing his own album. And then he disappeared off the face of the earth. I couldn't find him under a rock, and no one would tell me where he was. I called Truly Mean, who was our manager at the time. All she'd say is, Joe's unavailable. Unfucking available. Then a few months later, I heard my own band was trying to replace me, and I was like, what the fuck? They don't get it. It's all in the fucking mix. Robert's Banshee Wail syncs with Jimmy's plaintive Gibson EDS 1275 to make that high-octane Led Zepp sound. With us, it's the screaming demon's howl from hell and Joe's raunchy blues grind that makes Aerosmith's 150-proof moonshine, pumped out by Brad, Joey, and Tom. It's the collective vibe of four or five people tuned into each other that makes the bee sting and the honey drip. I knew what I had to do. Gotta fly back to my hive, talk that jive, and hit the road again with that beautiful, dirty Aerosmith liquid hydrogen snarl that makes the liver quiver, the knees freeze, and the booty shake. And that's an understatement. But my feet were still writhing in pain. I could barely walk, and if I was to go out on tour, I needed to prance. The band wanted to tour, and Aerosmith was my first love, a fucking gift from God, but I questioned whether I could even be on stage. The band said, ah, come on out anyway, Steven, you can sit in a chair. In a chair? In a fucking chair? Who did they think I was, Lightning Hopkins? I'm a dancer. I can't even sit still under normal conditions. So on stage? Forget about it. I ground my teeth in anger at my brethren, you fucks, to discount my pain and think only about the money. So I was given the option. Either I could sit in a chair and sing, yeah, right, or... guess what? In the spring of 09, I went to see Dr. Brian McKeon again. He's going to know how to take care of my problem, I figured. He treats athletes, and they're all crippled at 40, all on some kind of painkiller. He did prescribe something really effective, something that attacked the higher centers of pain, so I could at least get on stage without being plunged into the hell of screaming skulls. Effectively medicated, I went on the Aerosmith ZZ Top tour. The so-called A to Z tour, which began in Maryland Heights, Missouri on June 10th, 2009. It wasn't long before I began abusing my meds. On the list of side effects, sleeplessness, nausea, sweating, headaches, they should add, may cause patient to respond in an inappropriate manner to the horse shit of others. I wanted to explain to the band why I was on drugs. It wasn't, as many cynically believed, oh, that's Steven, wanting to get high. It was me trying to get through the pain, and I fell hard because it was hard. I sacrificed my sobriety and my sanity, and I did it all for them. Sob. The tour was going fine. I was planning to work on my book, The Very Thing You Hold in Your Hands. But Dave Dalton was sending me huge chunks of manuscript, and I was having a hard time reading that many pages. I told him, only send me 20 pages at a time. But did he? Not that it would have made that much difference, because on serious doses of loon-fucking-esta and the Suboxone, I was in the way-out-osphere and not really up to reading 20 fortune cookies, never mind 20 pages of Stephen-fucking-ography. It's not that easy to revisit your checkered past while snorting long lines of Lunesta, which I was spending too much time in my room doing. It's funny, after all the drugs that I ever did, all the coke and the rest of it, now... I am on Lunesta? Lunesta? The least of the sleeping meds, but I just needed to do it. I was flying on the wings of Lunesta, and that, along with the Suboxone that I was taking, supposedly one of, but by now I was up to two or three. Suboxone is used to treat opiate addiction, but it has a morphine derivative in it, so... but never the day of the show. August 5th, 2009, Sturgis, North Dakota. The Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. It's a big day because my brother-in-law Mark DiRico and I were building our Red Wing motorcycles, and Red Wing was going to be named Bike of the Year there. Sturgis is biker heaven, and I was getting nicely loaded. I was there with my friend Justin Murdoch. Justin's downstairs with me and Aaron, and Mark and the family were upstairs in the hotel. The night comes, we play the gig, I fall off the stage, and suddenly everybody is on a witch hunt for Justin. They just assumed he was the one who had given me the drugs. Now, Justin's like my father. He can't drink more than one beer, two beers tops. No one gave me any drugs. I was using, if you can call it that, doing the Lunesta. And instead of eating the three pills prescribed me, I was snorting them too, at night. That's all. Compared to what anyone who went to see Hendrix swallowed or smoked at a B&O or Woodstock, Lunesta? What the fuck? That's like smoking banana peels. After all my running in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, I'm smoking banana peels? You know ain't nothing in that. It's like, what the fuck? Here's what happened that night, moment by moment, in Tylorama. The night of the show, we're backstage, we're waiting to go on. There's a terrible thunderstorm. Lightning puts out the electricity on half the stage, and the floor is flooded, soaking wet. They're trying to mop up the stage, and consequently, the show is held back an hour. A fucking hour. Anyway, we get out there, and we get to Love in an Elevator. Suddenly, the sound goes out. My microphone is dead. I walk back to Joey and go, "Can you hear?" No response. So I make a T sign for time out, and he runs his finger across his neck like he's slitting his throat, signaling, "No, I can't." I begin walking slowly back down to the front of the stage to start singing Love in an Elevator. But half the PA system is out in the front of the house, and just to keep the audience entertained, I do one of my Tyler moves, and I fell off the side of the stage. I zigged when I should have zagged, and I fall 8 feet 10 inches. Right then and there, I knew the world was going to know I fell off the stage and what they were going to think. And there it was, the whole thing on YouTube as soon as I got to the hospital 20 minutes later. I just figured, what the fuck? I'll say, yep, I was high, and just call a spade a spade. Tyler falls off stage. Tyler fucked up on drugs. I could have sidestepped the whole thing by saying I zigged when I should have zagged. Backstage, they laid me out in my dressing room on a gurney, and only Brad Whitford came back to see how I was. Only guy in the band. When I fell off the stage, a soon-to-be band member's wife yelled at my manager, "You know what happens when you let him hang out with drug addicts?" So after falling off the stage, everyone got so mad at me, no one in the band called me for 27 weeks. I'm not sure how deep I would want to go with this, but it's just fucking ironic, isn't it? That not one of those fucks came to see what was going on with me. And when I asked them a couple of months ago, what the fuck? They said, "Well, we were angry at you." Angry? They were angry at me for falling off the stage? That was the best that they could come up with. After falling off the stage, I started the healing process, and 12 weeks later, I went out on the road to do a few makeup gigs with the band. San Francisco, Honolulu, Maui. Or we'd have been sued. I did them, but I still wasn't talking to the band. I had my manager get me a Winnebago so that I wouldn't have to go backstage and see any of them. Not once did I talk to any one of those pricks. I got out on stage that first night in San Francisco, but not one word did I speak. I shot daggers at them, smiled, put my arm around Joe, thinking, "You fuck." I remember looking at Joey. He and I had always had a laugh together, but I just stared him down. I read a book by Og Mandino called The Greatest Salesman in the World, where it says if you tell yourself when you're angry at your friend that you love him, he'll feel it. It works. But at that moment, I looked at Joey and said silently to myself, "I hate you, you fucking piece of shit." I didn't know what else to do, and it was one of the best shows we've ever done. I got chastised for falling off the stage high. That I may have done. I guess some are yet to fall off their own stage. I see people in this band who drink and fuck up and drink, and if I ever point that out to them, they always say, "Yeah, but I didn't do what you did." The hypocritical finger-pointing shit, I don't have a problem. Yet. And then, lo and behold, what do I see not so long ago but one of the guys in the band mid-snorting? There was a fucking Luger at the end of his nose. I saw the picture. It was taken by a fan club girl, Amanda Eyre, of a certain member of the band with a fucking stalactite hanging out of his nose. It was a high-def image, so we zoomed in to see what the fuck color it was so we could figure out what drug he was snorting. When those gigs were over, I went to New York, got an apartment on the Upper West Side, and worked with Karen Pincus, who was helping me organize my book. During this time, the band was scouting for other lead singers behind my back and putting out rumors that I was leaving Aerosmith, that I had quit. On November 10th, 2009, I was at dinner with Aaron Brady, Mark Hudson, Mark's girlfriend, and Karen Pincus in New York, and there was a phone call from Paul Santo, Joe Perry's guitar player, saying, "Hey, we're playing down here at Irving Plaza, blah, blah, blah." And I thought, hold on a minute. Let's go get a limousine, we'll ride downtown to the theater, and wait outside until he's about to do his encore, then I'll run in and get up on stage and tell the world what happened. We orchestrated it like a movie where you go in, you go out, and no one gets hurt. Like the scene from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? I was going to go in and fucking take over. We put our plan into action. We called the limousine company. I said, "Karen, look up on the internet, find out what Joe played at his last show, and then we'll know exactly what song he does before he comes back and does his encore. Walk this way." Then we sent Karen into the theater as our satellite, as our mole. Karen went and stood right in front of Joe. Right away, she texts me, "Oh my God, I can't believe it. There's barely 200 to 300 people here. It's half empty." Poor Joe's in there playing to half an audience. Then Karen texts me again. "I think this is his last song." We run in, I meet the guys at the back door, and they recognize me. I tell them, "I gotta get on stage right now." They go, "Okay, okay, okay, Mr. Tyler." We're like a snake running through the crowd, this way and that. I see Billy Perry, she sees me and goes, "Joe, Joe, Steven's here." She starts freaking. It's Alyssa Perry, the Wicked Witch of the North again. Billy, Alyssa, same woman. If you ever meet guys who have had 3-4 wives, you know they keep getting married to the same woman over and over. They pick a new woman who's just like the old one every time. Nothing else will do. If you're a sex addict, you're not going to go look for a date in a library. So I go backstage. Joe's just come off, and I walk in the room and go, "Hey, Joe, what's going on?" He goes, "Nothing." I say, "Having a rough night?" He doesn't answer me. I say, "Joe, let's go up there. I want to do Walk This Way with you." He introduces me to his lead singer, some German kid named Hagen Grohe. I say, "I know, I heard you up there. How you doing?" And shake his hand. Joe says, "Here's what's going to happen. My guy Hagen's going to take a verse, then you take a verse." And I go, "Well, now, you know that just ain't going to happen." I should have said, "Fuck you, I'm singing it. What are you going to do about it?" Just like when I was growing up, the guys in the gangs, that's what they did. "Fuck you, I'm stealing your day. What are you going to do about it, prick?" That was the kind of words that went down in Yonkers among the Green Mountain Boys. But instead, what I said was, "Come on, Joe, let's go. Let's go do this thing." There was tension and an ominous silence that you could cut with a knife. It was bullshit. I said, "Joe, come on, man. They're waiting for you." I walked out. And he had to follow me. I grabbed the mic and the place was roaring. They gave us a standing ovation for at least a minute. That's a long fucking time when you're up there. It seemed like 2 minutes of whistling, clapping, and hollering. I got them to quiet down. I said, "All right, here's what's happening. I'm gonna sing with Joe tonight. The rumors about me quitting the band aren't true. And Joe, you're a man that wears a coat of many colors. But I, motherfucker, am the rainbow." I thought, where the fuck did I get that from? You get these moments when you know how the movie's going to go. I said, "Count it off, drummer boy." And we did the song, and when it was done, I jumped off the stage into the crowd, went out into the limousine and went, what just happened? Eventually, I moved into my daughter Liv's brownstone in the Village. She was off doing a movie. During Thanksgiving, I drank, did some blow again, and then Christmas was coming up, so I had a guy bring me an 8-ball of Coke and a bunch of pills. And those deliveries got through Aaron a couple times. But by December, the last package arrived and Aaron saw it and said, "What is this?" I said, "Give me that." I pulled it away from her and the package ripped. Cocaine went all over the place. I went back later that night and snorted it all up, off the counters and everywhere, and got a nice fucking rail out of it. It was pretty cool. It's interesting how fast you can go back to romancing your drug. I got laid the first time on coke. I've done every fucking drug under the sun. I've smoked combs, for Christ's sakes. You'd buy a nickel plastic comb in the men's room at a gas station, cut all the teeth off, stick one in the end of a cigarette, and smoke the plastic. Pure poison. But like they used to say in the Renaissance, dosis sola facit venenum, which translates to something like, only the quantity makes the poison. A very cool saying by Paracelsus, a 16th century alchemist and doctor. All things are poisons, he said, for there is nothing without poisonous qualities. It is only the dose which makes a thing poison. I love it. Anyway, amo amas amat. And December 14th rolls around, and I'm laying in bed, wiped out from arguing all day with Dave Dalton. I've been having a shitty week, which got a whole lot worse after Aaron found my shit. 4 a.m., she wakes me up and says, "Guess where you're going?" "Betty Ford." I called my friend Frank Angie, who sent his plane for me. The guy loves me. He'll do anything for me. We flew out to L.A., then flew over to Palm Springs, where I made a brief pit stop to grab a double-double In-N-Out burger, where they baked the fries in the bun, for my last meal in civilian life. Oh, you know what I forgot to say? We have to put it in right here. Just before that tour where I fell off the stage, I was in New York. I was up here on the west side and went to this little restaurant where I met my new manager, Alan Kovac, who I'd met through his partner at 10th Street Entertainment, Eric Sherman. I told him about my problems and what was going on with the band. The day before I went to Betty Ford, I said to Alan, "Get me something else, something besides the band. I need to have some backup plan outside of Aerosmith." My father used to tell me, "Always have a backup plan, something you can fall back on." Aerosmith wasn't exactly a sure thing anymore. They were looking around for other lead singers. And I was getting calls from Lenny Kravitz, who was wondering if I was really quitting the band. I knew I was going to be all right after the second day at Betty Ford. I went from detox to the community, having, ironically enough, come to Betty Ford high on the very same drug they wound up giving me to deal with my addiction, Suboxone. They let me out in a day, only to be greeted by this guy who said, "Hi, I'm the Kings of Leon's dad." His kids didn't like the way their dad was behaving. He'd remarried and they hated his new wife. He was getting drunk all the time, running trucks and buses off the road. He was the band's tour manager. Just fucked up shit. So they sent him to rehab, and so I spent the next month in the best of company with the Kings of Leon's dad. After detoxing and spending a month at Betty Ford, I was talked into spending 2 more months there. After the first month at Betty Ford, they put you in what's called the Lane. It's a house in a cul-de-sac. I lived there with 4 other guys, 3 rooms, 2 guys in each bedroom. The first day I was there, I went, "Wait a minute, you guys are doctors?" "Yup." One was shooting fentanyl, a potent narcotic painkiller, and the other was delivering babies and stealing all the drugs he could get his hands on. They all had to submit to random urine tests or they'd never get their licenses back. There was a pilot there who flew a route from England to America. On the day of the flight, he was dead drunk and fell out of the truck taking him to the plane he was about to fly. His best friend, thank God, grabbed him and sent him into rehab. Can you imagine what would have happened if he'd taken off and flown the plane bombed out of his mind? That's who I was in rehab with. I decided I'm just going to do it, too. The random urines and whatever, I don't give a fuck. At this stage of the game, you're kind of a little like, I will follow the program wherever it takes me. I will do whatever it is to get through this. I knew that after the first month in rehab that my not calling anybody in the band was really fucked up. It was one thing for those suckasses to not call me for 27 weeks. It was quite another thing when I didn't call them, because when you're in rehab, you look at your own side of the street. It was then that I realized that I loved the band. regardless of a guitar player that's a loose cannon and doing a solo record and angry at me for doing stuff he'd done half a dozen times himself. And suddenly, I'm Peck's bad boy? There's the pot calling the kettle beige. After I'd been there 2 months, I was told I could go home for a week, which I did. I had a meeting with the band, at which time I begged their forgiveness and sincerely apologized for my behavior. Looking around the room, I realized that although we had all allegedly gotten sober in the late 80s, some of us didn't exactly stay with the program. Some of us never did get sober. I did. Joey followed. But not everybody cleaned up, and that's the sad truth. Naturally, I'm always the identified patient. If you get Steven sober, then you'll have a band. You need the lead singer. You can't lose him. I begged their dodgy forgiveness and said, let's go out on tour when I get out of Betty Ford. When I got out of rehab that day on the 15th of March, there was a song that needed to be written for $1 million. The next day and the day after that, I'm writing that song with Marty Fredrickson and Cara DioGuardi, who was the judge from American Idol. We came up with a great song called Love Lives for a Japanese movie called Space Battleship Yamato. Then we're on tour again. After a month of rehearsing, we hit Caracas, Venezuela, May 18th, 2010. Caracas of your asses was the running joke. And it was one of the best tours we'd ever done. It was a bit ironic and a thorn in my side, but not worth getting angry over after spending 3 months in rehab, that I came back to a band where someone was still using. I don't give a fuck. I live for this band, but the world needs to know. South America, Europe, the United States. Where are we going to go with this? Oh, yeah, Caracas of your asses. Some of the districts there were beyond the third world. They were more like the fourth world. They were selling incense and papaya, goat's heads, sugar skulls, and monkey meat, anything you can imagine. While I was there, I went downtown to the area where they used to torture people, looking for an AA meeting. My own personal inquisition. Where is it? ¿Dónde es? Oh, it's up there. You climb up the spiral steps of this building in the middle of downtown. It was the old hellhole jail. And you walk into the interrogation room. That will sober you right up fast. That's where all the bad shit happened. And it's an AA meeting. 2 fucking hours, drinking nothing but black coffee with tons of sugar in it in these little plastic cups. Not one word did I understand, but I picked up on their passion. They were doing Caracas drugs, opium, heroin, drinking. When we go on tour to a new place, I like to get to each gig 2 nights ahead of the band because I like to walk around, get a feel for the town, and get a good night's rest before the first show. I brought a sober companion with me, Chappie, one of the stars on Brotherhood. Very funny guy at the beginning of the series with a huge cock. I mean, clock. Doc. The Jay Giles band tried to throw their lead singer, Peter Wolf, out, too. I had had a nice long talk with him. I said, these fucking guys, they're trying to find a new lead singer because I'm in rehab. Can you believe that? While I'm down on my knees at my lowest ebb, what do I find? My old band of brothers is auditioning lead singers to replace me, as if that were even possible. 40 fucking years of brotherly love, knockdown fights, and drug hoarding. Did that mean nothing to them? And now they want to replace me? And all because I fell off a stage? The exact same thing Joe Perry's done 5 times before I did it. Wait. I need a witness. Can I get a witness? Isn't that why they called us the Toxic Twins? Because of... Peter Wolf looked at me like Mr. Natural saying, what else is new? June 29th, 2010. We were on tour in France when Cara DioGuardi texted me asking if I've ever thought about being a judge on American Idol, because apparently she didn't want to continue doing it. I didn't know. Like a dummy, I went, does it still have high ratings? She's going, oh, yeah. So I said, well, I'll get back to you. Early July, I'm on a plane coming back from England to start the American leg of the tour, and there's an in-flight movie called The Backup Plan playing. There'd already been rumors and grumblings about my doing American Idol. My own internal interrogator is going, can you do it, Steven? Do you want to do it, lad? I said, you know, yeah, I do. 3 weeks later, we're getting ready to begin the American tour down in Florida. And that's when I said, you know, I'm just going to fucking do it. And I signed the papers. I hadn't told the band yet. When we get to Vegas, Joe barges into my dressing room and accosts me. What the fuck's going on? And I, all innocent, said, what? Well, how come I'm finding out about this in the press? Why didn't you tell me? And I say, well, come on, man. 2 months ago, you were trying to throw me out of the band, so I got myself a job. That way I've got something steady while you guys are trying to figure out what you want to do. It's all water under the bridge now. It's all this bullshit that happens because band's wives get to talking to the guys in the band. When we're on stage, none of that shit's there. But when they're off the road, their wives start pecking them to death. It was ironic, to say the least, that I came out of rehab, the very place I wound up because the band was mad at me for getting high and falling off the stage, only to find that two of them are still using. The day I came out of rehab is the day the rest of the band should have gone in. Nevertheless, the tour was beyond successful, and we end up August 15th, 2010 at Fenway Park on a double bill blowout with Jay Giles, twin bad boys from Boston, selling out the stadium. The last show on the tour was September 16th in Vancouver, and then, next stop, American Idol. Hey, like my dad said, make sure you have something to fall back on in case your day job doesn't pan out. And boy, what a day job I got. Chapter 17. Take a Walk Inside My Mind. Ah, yes, it was the best of rhymes, it was the worst of rhymes. I've been mythicized, micicized, eulogized, and foolagized. I've been Cole-ported and farmer's daughtered. I've been Led Zepped and 12-stepped. I'm E to the Z-O Tweedledee. I'm a rhyming fool that weren't learned in no school. Me, Fritz the Cat, and Mohair Sam are the baddest cats. What is what am? Every time that I look in the mirror, all these lines on my face getting clearer. The past is gone and went by like dusk to dawn. Isn't that the way? Everybody's got their dues in life to pay. Dream on. I wrote that when I was 17. And sometimes I feel like that young kid, this 17-year-old who just wormholed himself into this 60-year-old man. The voice seems fine, but then there's my feet, my knee, and my throat. But when I hit the stage, something miraculous happens. I go on tour, and after a month, I turn into Peter fucking Pan. The band is my happy thought, and then I get my wings again. It's my fountain of youth. I get so strong from the workout that I'm zapped back into being a 20-year-old. And it's not that I feel that way, but it is that I am that way. Janice, Jimmy, Jim Morrison, Keats, and Brian Jones. Didn't they all die at 26 or 27? It's that weird doomed age. And I always wondered, since we all shared the same lifestyle, would I live past that glorious age? And guess what? I've been lucky. I've lived long past that. I was born on March 26th, so I always wondered what I'd look like when I was 26. It's funny, when I was a teenager and way before Aerosmith, I would dry my hair after a shower with a blow dryer and search for my face in the foggy mirror because I couldn't see my reflection. I aimed the dryer at the cloud of glass. There I was at 90, and then the slow melt back to 19. Every time that I look in the mirror. Gee, sounds familiar. But the singer didn't arrive until the song was written. Life is like a roll of toilet paper. The closer it gets to the end, the faster it goes. Aaron and I were sitting on the lawn in Sunapee, New Hampshire one morning, and the phone rang. It was Billy Joel. He asked me if I'd like to play the final show that Shea Stadium would ever see. I told him I saw the Beatles there in 1965 and that I'd love to do it. He sent a plane for us, and we were on our way. Jump to, I'm backstage in my dressing room when Billy Joel walks in, saying his hellos. He introduces me to Tony Bennett, who to me is a god, second only to Frank Sinatra. And I'm sharing a dressing room with him. Who'd have thunk? Tony then introduces me to his son, who asks me, do you know whose jacket this is? It's in my dressing room, so I'm thinking, it gotta be mine, but no, I tell him, it reeks of Sergeant Pepper. at which time he says, "Yeah, and it's Ringo's." And he lets me try it on. Turns out, he's one of the largest collectors of Beatles memorabilia in the history of memory. So here I am, 60 days sober, 60 years old, 60,000 people in the audience and in the house. Sir Paul fucking McCartney as the extra special guest, flown in from London that evening, who's closing the show with, "I saw her standing there." 43 years since I heard the Beatles open up with that at the same stadium back in 1965. We flew back to Sunapee that night, and sitting out on the lawn in the dark, the same lawn where we had been that morning, I asked myself, what just happened? What did I just do? Living on the tail of a comet, it's all so fast. It's such an age of supersonic travel, transcendental or otherwise, an instant everything, that life can become a blur for me. When we tour, we often hub in Minneapolis, fly to Detroit after that, and 2 hours later, we're back in the same hotel, hitting the sheets by four and thinking, where were we tonight? When you rattle it back and forth, memories of what that tour was like, it all blends together. Plane, limo, lobby, backstage, encore, limo, lobby, dressing room, plane. It's just a big fucking blur. Sometimes it feels like all I'm doing is rearranging deck chairs in the fucking Titanic. And then I wonder why I don't dream anymore. My subconscious must be saturated. What I've seen. Faces that remind me of faces. Places that remind of other places I've never even been to yet. It's just another example of Vuja Day. I could talk to you forever about the people I've met in the shadows of time, and the vibrations between musical fifths, even in the spaces between the words you're hearing right now. But when I zero in, things come into focus. When I went back and looked at my yearbook, seems like everybody I ever knew was there in those 20 small pages. Different people maybe, but then one tends to morph into another. Those 40 or 50 kids in your graduating class, you never thought their faces would bleed into the future. And so now I realize after peering into my own yearbook that the guy who was sitting next to me in Woodshop looks exactly like the president of Sony. Where am I going with this? Whatever happened to a good melody? Maybe to be the headline speaker at the Alzheimer's convention with speech in hand, to an empty house that forgot how to get there. Gasp. Only to wake up in front of President Obama, Oprah, and Paul McCartney singing last four songs of Abbey Road at the 2010 Kennedy Awards. And you tell me I'm not living the dream? One day, after my mom had passed, my dad sent me an email which said, "Don't wait until it's the last minute to make the phone call. And use one of the quarters I gave you for these calls as a kid." So I wrote him this little poem. Once upon a dime, I felt so alone. So I first made a call on the last payphone. Something so strange inside of me stirred. So I knew I'd be the first to get the last word. I screamed, "Oh, Lordy, is this my time? I feel like the first at the back of the line." So it's all your fault, and it seems to me I was on the last payphone in NYC. Along with everything else that's happened, life is good. And I've learned that if I shoot an arrow of truth, I must first dip its point in honey. I've learned the ancient lesson of apology. Own it. It puts out every fire you may have walked through in life. People, too, often miss the silver lining because they were expecting gold. I've seen the sun go down only to be swallowed by the ocean, only to rise again in the morning. I fell in love with B.B. Buell, and on July 1st, 1977, my first baby, Liv, arrived. I married Sarinda Fox, and soon Mia was born on December 22nd, 1978. Then I married Teresa, and along came Chelsea. And 2 years later, my man-child, Taj, was born. Fatherhood changed me forever. I wept when I heard Chelsea sing in kindergarten. I burst with pride when Taj graduated high school. My heart broke from the honesty that Mia put in her book, and how Liv dazzles me in her movies. And now I'm ever so humbled by the way she loves Milo. Some of the marriages weren't so happy for everyone, but most of the times we had were great. There wasn't a woman that I had a child with that I didn't love. But there were always two trains running, my family, my band. Sometimes toward each other and other times away. And a lot of the women in my life couldn't understand that. Seems like the light at the end of the tunnel may be you. You write a song with somebody, and it's like having a child with them. The songs are my spirit children. You're evoking the spirits, conjuring up moments in time. Ephemeral seconds when you hear that, oh yeah, sound in your head and catch the scat on the wing, or it's gone. I now live in Laurel Canyon. I can't believe I live where all my idols once lived. The very houses I drive by and wonder what fantastic scenes were going down in there. Jim Morrison lived one house down from me. Mama Cass, three doors away. Chris Hillman of the Byrds, two houses away from her. Frank Zappa and the GTOs, Joni Mitchell and Carol King lived across the street from the guys in Buffalo Springfield. John Mayall, the Magus of the Blues Breakers, lived there briefly, as did Jimi Hendrix and Errol Flynn's old house. It's hard to tell who I am by the trail left by my musical career. I am the demon of screaming, the dude that looks like a lady, the rag doll that married Lucy in the sky. But I'm also something more than the rock and roll junkie whore who got his foot inside the door. Sure, were the sum of our experiences. If you listen to that song I wrote in 1969, Dream On, you might get a different view. I may not have been quite sure of what I was doing, but I was on to something. Just saying. This is Jeremy Davidson. This recording of Does the Noise in My Head Bother You?, a rock and roll memoir by Steven Tyler with David Dalton, was produced and directed by Scott Sherritt. Executive producer, Karen Jakonski. Text copyright 2011 by Steven Tyler. Production copyright 2011 by HarperCollins Publishers. We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. For more information about the broad range of titles from Harper Audio, Harper Children's Audio, and Cadman, please visit harperaudio.com. Thank you for listening.
God, a memoir like this is beyond cathartic. It's one step better than having an album with your songs on it from the 70s and it being 2010. So when you put on the headphones and you listen to the beginning of Sweet Emotion, you have all of this incredible room sound that you were in then and can totally relate to. It's so strong that you can almost smell it when you're in the headphones listening to the beginning of Sweet Emotion. For someone like me who wrote it, sang it, was in the studio, and knows what went on. It's just listening to it brings me totally back. However, conversely, doing a book, you bring up things that you didn't remember happened. And as soon as you do, it opens up that place in your mind that you spew out onto the pages that just, it's like watching your own yearbook, your own personal yearbook. And I hope that that's what this is. Well, and it's kind of interesting, the way it was in the 70s was a bit of a blur. A lot of it I do remember, but because of the enhancement of the drug use, bringing it up again, sober, and remembering back then, remembering those years so vividly, like the night at the lake, that you got drunk on 4 6-packs with your cousin. Thinking about it now, I'm not sure if it's the thoughts that come back to me are true thoughts, but the remembrances of those times are so acute, if that's a good word, to my sensory structure that it just gives me goosebumps listening to it, reading back what I put down on the pages. It's kind of like getting hypnotized and somebody asking you what happened then and what you say under hypnosis as opposed to what we think now. It's a bit, especially digging the stuff out with pen and paper. It's a phenomenal process. I don't think I could have, I'm really glad I wrote this book because I don't think I would have, ever been able to unearth and remember the things that happened had I not really delved into it early in the morning every day with a shitload of coffee and friends who reminded me of things that happened to evoke these memories that I could put on paper. When you're in a band and it's 40 years later and you're going back to the very derivation of things that happened, and it gets mythologized. It's like reading Walk This Way. It was Tom's opinion in the book of the suitcase. It was Joey's opinion of it. And then it was Joe's idea or opinion of what it was. And then it was my idea who I found the suitcase. And so after all those years of hearing everybody's story, it became so puffed up and overblown. Like, you know, like when I trapped and how many years it was. It was 2 years. But thinking about the Green Mountain Boys, and it seemed like it was forever. It was only 4 years. And what it was like on tour with the Kinks, which was 4 weeks. But in the mythologizing of things, it get puffed up and blown much bigger. And sometimes I'm not sure if I like that better than what really happened. Sometimes it's good when it's puffed out of shape. Not always good when it was, yeah, I'm the one to carry this ass off a stage every night. Bullshit, not true. Sometimes maybe, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? What came first, the fame which I was thirsting for when I would tell my bandmates the Chain Reaction before our Columbia, was it CBS or whatever it was back then in 1967? We got a contract with them and I said, I just want my foot in the door. Just if I can get the tip of my big toe. Kind of like what you said to your girlfriend. Let me just put the tip in. just get my big toe in to the industry. Just to be, if I knew, I knew that if I could just stand in the doorway for a moment, they'd never get me out. That was my belief system. Totally and 100%. And, you know, after it happened and we hit, I think the talent was always there. But, you know, so many kids are stunned young. No one tells them they're any good. My mom was forever telling me I was great. A lot of people say you'll never make it. My mom told me I'd make it. No one said that you could ever write songs. And with the band and the guys I got with After Chain Reaction, Aerosmith, I knew we could. And once Joe Perry and I wrote a song, we got into that fame place where it unearthed all the talent that was there because we were, you know, like mushroom farmers, you know, kept in the dark and couldn't play here and couldn't get on tour. And once we made it, we started playing on tour with the Kinks and Mahavishnu Orchestra and those other bands, I think the talent bubbled out. If you look at most of the 70s, it all came out because that was the first year this band made it big. And then this book is about a lot of the things that happened in the wake of. Just like when you have a hit song, you know, it's like surfing. It's like the wave is your album and the band is your surfboard and the hit singles will take you as far in the wave, will take you as long as there's a wave. You can surf that damn thing all the way to the shore. So that coupled with I think I can, the little tug said, just it makes your creativity bubble up and come out of places I didn't even know it was. It even existed. Moving out was a lick. Joe's famous for licks. And I threw verse on it. And it became a song, the first song we ever wrote. So beforehand, the I Think I Can's, afterwards, being put in that arena of the label and managers and places to play in front of with the Kinks, it all just came out. It worked. It was like we were on automatic at that time. You know, when I wrote Dream On, I grew up listening to my father, Juilliard, pianist, full-on classical, Bach, Brahms, Chopin, Debussy. So all that music was in my head from growing up under the piano, and it's like my daughter today, Chelsea. She's heard so much music and doesn't play the piano, never did. However, I sat down, because her ear is so good, and I played Dream On, and she learned it in 4 hours. I knew the Beatles came out, and the Stones, and Melody, and all these different bands, the Animals, and this melody started flowing into me, and I thought, and it evoked those classical notes in me, hence Dream On. I mean, you think? And then other melodies came out, and I was a freak for melody. We all live on the edge of town. Repeat, where we all live ain't a soul. Now we go down, around. People starting coming, oh, a zoo just to go up, grin. Payoff. Yeah, we gotta move out, cause the city's moving in. Whoops. Song done. Done. Now fill that in with lyric and you got it. Once that hit, that was so much fun for me because I had a guitar player that was playing and I didn't have to sit at the piano and get lost in 88 keys of insane nutsness that was going in my head. It was hard to wrangle it down to a few simple nothings. Interestingly enough, I've taught Chelsea every song, my daughter, that I know that hasn't gone on record. In case something happens to me someday, it would still live in her fingers and she could get it out. And also those things that I wrote way back when are so interesting now. I played them the other night and I almost freaked. I thought, oh my God, solo album. But the creative process never stops. Once you learn that I can, and you can play a 6-hole flute, you can never stop. For the lack of those, of all the rest of the notes, as long as you got 6, you can write a million melodies. Well, the easiest thing in the world to do is play. Okay, the bands play. When we would rehearse with the band in the early days, we played. But then, someone's gotta write the lyrics. Whoops. So playing's like getting in a car, but the lyrics is like getting under the hood, working on the engine, working on the tires, working on the doors, making sure the roof opens up. If there's a chorus, the roof wants to open up and the sun comes in. So it's easy to play. But what I did with the band is I'd play with them and I would get off and then I would sing along. I would scat. Is that what goes and did that? And I would come out of that. I would come up with, is anybody out there? It kind of sounded like that, but not, but kind of, but not, but kind of. And I'd sit like this and listen until I wrote the lyric down that I heard in my scat. Cosmic? Maybe. I never did save any of those old scats. I wish I did. For like crying and I was crying when I mean, all that shit was just, my boo did that, boo boo did that. I just scatted something. For lack of anything. I waited for the music to move me. And when it moved me, I just sang what it moved. I sang the movement. And that's how it's done. I mean, for me. Now, other songs I've sat with and thought, you know, Jenny got a gun. That was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 little notes. And I thought, why does Jenny have a gun? And I didn't know, but I just loved singing it. So I promised myself I wasn't letting go of it. Janie had a gun. What? Why? And who's Janie? It's like art, imitating art, and who is art anyway? And so it's that process of filling in the blanks. I got a hold of the Newsweek. It was about shooting gun crimes for 24 hours or 48 hours and made up that Janie had a gun because, well, obviously she's abused. I'd come from a rehab where I was working on codependency to embrace my band and learn how to speak more with honey than with vinegar, because when I don't get my way, I tend to snap out, leash out at them, and why are you doing that? Do this. And so I went away for a month to deal with codependency, and I learned that so many crimes of passion are about abuse in lots of ways, verbally, sexually. And so I thought that Janie got abused in the worst way, sexually. And I told Fincher, and we did a movie all around that, and it was just one thing led from a tiny, Janie got the runs, I mean, got a gun. No, there wasn't one particular artist that spurred me on. It was, in my mind, there was confusion. You know, it's interesting. The more I peel back the layers of the onion to try to find out what's going on, you know, in my mind at certain times that things were going on big, you know, it was like finger painting. I had the high lows on one ear, Janis Joplin in the other ear, Nat King Cole up here, and the Beatles down here. But I knew I loved melody. I knew that melody was the key to me. When I heard a song, what is a song? song is melody. Now, what is the melody that stands out? Usually the chorus. You know, and is the chorus something that's melodic and memorable? Or something which is like Nat King Cole's Chemo, Chymo, Stare, Stare, Mahai, Maho, Marumstick, a Pumpernickel, Soup, Bang, Nipcat, Parliament, Cameo, I Love You. Was that the earliest forms of rap? I don't know. The melody that went along with it was very simple. It was very sweet. It was like, the eensy-weensy spider went up the water spout. I mean, you know, the melody to me is key. I once sat down with a bunch of, with about 23-year-olds when I was taking my daughter to school. And I was trying to check her into this one school in Florida. And this woman was trying to brag about how great this kindergarten was. That these 40 kids that were 3 and 4 years old knew every star in the galaxy, which I don't know and you don't know. No one here knows. How did they do it? They threw rhyme on it. They threw melody on it. You can't just come up with, well, it's, let me see, the Earth and then there's Pluto and Saturn and, you know, that way you got to think. But they threw melody on it. It was astounding to me how that worked. And how I know, being a songwriter, that the future of this world, it's only 2011 right now, but trust me, by 2020, no school will teach kids something without melody. Because here's 3-year-olds going, Mercury, Venus, the Earth, and Mars, these are the planets that dwell near the stars. Jupiter, Saturn, and Uranus too. Mercury, Venus, I know them. Do you? Holy fucking shit. It's genius that the memorabilia and the just sheer mention of that with melody would evoke such remembrances of young children, 3 and 4 year old, as that. They'll never forget that for the rest of their lives. So I'm listening to Beatles songs, I'm going, oh my God, yes, it's evoking our everyday stuff. Yes, it's evoking, you know, she came through the bathroom window to yesterday, oh my love, to, you know, dream on. But what if that beautiful sticky goo of melodicy was thrown onto something that needed to be remembered, that needed to be remembered in the worst way? I think it's something that's so magical, it's been left out of schooling. It's going to be in there. You need schooling. Oh, baby, I'm not fooling. No, that song wrote itself from be-do-de-do, 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 that-that-that-de-do-de, C-sharp, C-C-C, with a C-bottom. To rock that is insane. It moved my world. It was Debussy. It was, oh my God, it was wrong but right, and it was so sweet, and I just started singing. Every time that you, when the past is gone, it went. I don't know. The song kind of wrote itself. I try to think back of, did I get it from anybody? I didn't. The chordage that I was playing, the intonations spurred it. You know, it's kind of like, why does a dog, when someone's playing the fiddle, go, whoa! Think about it. It's mocking it. So I mocked those notes, the 88, the piano talked to me. That Steinway, I love it. It just spews out. And then, dream on, dream yourself, dream come true. And then, dream on, dream on. And I, you know, dream on! It's just, you know what? Coupled with the fact it was something I could do, like why does a bald dog, you know, lick himself? Because he can. Coupled with the fact that I think I just did that because I can. I think. The fact that in my head I had all that classical and wanted to break out in the worst way. Janis Joplin, dig it and take another little piece of my heart now, baby. You know you got it. If it makes you feel good. Oh, is it? You know, just that oof. You know, when I heard that, I realized it's not about the notes anymore. Singing it anyway. The feeling, the sexuality, and the tell-it-like-it-isness of that sort of thing is why I kind of sort of wanted to write a book. To define in words, not only in music. You know, again, that I can. Joe always says, I'll do a song, and I'm doing the vocal, and I'm, of course, I complain, and it's a little high. And you know, but I push myself to do it, because I've been of the mind of, whatever band is on before us, If we don't blow them off, we're no good. And that's how we got to be better. I want to be better then. I want to do something better than the Stones did. Oh, my God, did I just say that? I want to write something better than Beggar's Banquet? Well, my interpretation was some of the stuff we did early on. It wasn't as seasoned as each album was something, although Joe's in the Attic and Rocks has their moments. But I always pushed myself to think that. Fake it till you make it, I've always said. So the next song, I didn't want to do it. Then 10 years later, was like, all that kind of thing. And I couldn't do that anymore. And then it was something else, which is a beautiful melodic. Don't want to miss a thing. But, you know, it was something where if I knew I could, I pushed. I always pushed myself to sing harder and find some place to get to. You got to bring it up for the chorus. And I can't sing flat out straight up past a two octaves, octave and a half above middle C. But I can go three octaves up by, yeah! I can do that. I can't hit that straight flat out. Come to find out, that's the best magical thing about my voice. And the doctors say that I got this in my larynx, that I've got a, you know, they meet, it's very vaginal. They meet in talking like this. And mine's got a little extra one right at the top. I got my own second pair of larynx up there from doing what I kind of mimicked Joplin, Janis is doing, and some of the earlier people. I want to say Ewa Sumac, but she went, and she would go all the way up, and she had an incredible range. But I always was moved the most by people that could do that, and that was my flair. Why not do it? Flaunt it if you got it. When in doubt, whip it out. You know, we played in clubs until I was hoarse, and there was a fan that followed us around way back when, and I called her Shire. I know who she was. She was a real mystery girl. We rocked. She was one of the first people that I had sex with that just rocked my world. And that coupled with playing the clubs and giving me this macrame shirt, because in clubs there were no fans. I mean, there were Aerosmith fans, but it was beyond, it was excruciating heat. It was had to be 100 degrees every night. In gyms, and we were on the floor. There was no stage. And so this macrame, after, you know, 300-400 shows, it started rotting. And I would hang the shirt off the mic stand. And then I got these scarves from Sindori Imports that used to be in the East Village. And, you know, one thing led to another. I was amazed at the way Janis Joplin looked. And that, they, you know, we were hippies back then. And nobody told us how to look. The look of disheveled was freedom. It wasn't the norm. It wasn't the suit and tie. That's easy. It was T-shirts and jeans and boots and smoking pot and the war sucked and fuck you because we can. And it was a lot of bleh. Just let it all hang out, as they said. And it was so perfect for music because music was so constricted and it was such a major form. And we wanted to break the mold and get out of the form. And I just fell into it. I thought I was being true to what I had on the inside and my father's playing piano. And I thought when I heard Joe Perry's band at the barn and they were doing Rattlesnake Shake, they couldn't tune. They were god awful. Every other song was forget about it. But that one song, they had the rhythm. They had the guitars playing all together and it was hot and it was nasty and sexy and in time. And I went, that's it. That's it. I'll throw my melody on it, my father's Juilliard, my sense of form, my thoughts of what a band should be, my thoughts. You know, I got shoved up your ass a lot back then because I saw other bands and I knew I could mimic. And in doing that, you know, you can come to your own thing. I didn't know how to do it any other way than get a band to, and that would unearth and unleash and that would, is how my creativity could grow. And I was a bitch to get along with, but always thought I knew something. And man, once I realized once we wrote that first song, it was all over. All over. Fame is the loss of anonymity. Interestingly enough, you could probably go the other way with it and say that you're so out in the open and vulnerable with it that it allows your creativity to dance. on an open stage, because the I Don't Give a Shits is a great place to be for just finding out who you are. I